Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Food shopping is essential to our health and survival, yet we're besieged by marketing claims about the pluses and minuses of nearly every food we see in a grocery store. For that reason and many others, farmers markets offer a welcome respite from the hype of processed food making and give us the opportunity to work directly with the people that grow and produce our food. What about organics? It always sounds good, free of chemical pesticides, herbicides, and there's a health connotation that comes with it, but it does have added price. In Tulsa, for now more than 20 years, we've been blessed with the Tulsa Farmers Market that runs outdoors from April through October on Cherry Street, and now has year-round daily offerings at the Mother Road Market. My guests today, Emily Oakley and Mike Appel, are the owners and operators of Three Springs Farm, which operates on a farm about an hour east of Tulsa in Oaks, Oklahoma. Three Springs is a successful, small-scale, sustainable organic farm that uses a model known as Community Supported Agriculture, or CSA. In that model, customers can buy a share of the harvest, which can be bountiful in good years or leaner in difficult times. But it's a shared risk model that builds community around the food source. Mike and Emily have committed to organic food production because of deep experience and knowledge into what makes organic produce healthier. In addition, they've been at the center of an economic and political struggle over commercial-scale chicken farming, which has threatened not only their livelihoods and residents, but those of their neighbors and our Northeast Oklahoma watersheds. Three Springs Farm owners and operators Emily Oakley and Mike Appel are my guests today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Emily Oakley and Mike Appel, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you describe why you became organic farmers.
Like most things, you know, in life, it's a long trajectory for us. We actually met 19 years old, undergraduate school, and it was actually at an agroecology class. And that kind of got us on that track. And really for me, growing up in suburban New York, I wasn't connected to a farm at all. And that first experience working on a little farm, part of that class, I fell in love with it, having my hands in the dirt and planting things. And at the end of the semester, we got to eat this big salad, and I was just blown away by the taste. I couldn't believe like how things taste. I was like, you don't even need salad dressing on this. This has so much taste, and just loved it. And from there, I went to do an internship on a farm in California, and we then studied international agriculture, part of our school. And so we traveled the world, visiting farms all over the place, learning a lot, and just seeing how important agriculture is to so many people in this on the planet. It's 50% more or less derive their income from farming or livelihood. And so we just saw that this agriculture is such a great way for us to connect with people, to connect with the planet. It was just this amazing intersection of so many issues was in farming. And so the more we studied, the more we fell in love with it. And after we graduated undergrad, we went to work on a farm in California, fairly large, successful, very well-known farm. And there is really where we honed our skills and developed even more of a love for the practicality of it. I think while we were in undergrad, it was more of the philosophical and social part. But there we developed more of just the love of the seasons of planting, of harvesting, of even weeding.
For you, maybe.
So we were there for 3 years. Emily did go to grad school during that time in international agriculture development. And we were kind of at this crossroads. What do we do? Do we go work for a nonprofit overseas? Or do we try to make a go of it as farmers? And, you know, we had these long conversations. I think we even took some retreats and sat by a creek for a little bit and talked about it. And we thought the world really needs more farmers. They don't need more people going to tell farmers what to do. The world needs more farmers, and especially more organic farmers. And so Emily, being from Oklahoma, we drove our little 87 Toyota Corolla across the country back to Oklahoma and just started looking for land, and became a lot harder to find land. So we ended up finding this through kind of networking, found a couple that was willing to let us till up their horse pasture, and which is now very close to Tulsa Hills, so West Tulsa. Super nice couple, didn't know us, and I don't even know if they ever said no to us. Anything we asked, it was always yes. It's the Knights. They have a pecan farm. So they had farming, experience and background, and kind of were, I think, sympathetic to the farming cause. And so we were there for 3 years and were able to sell to Cherry Street Farmers Market. So this was back in our first year at this farmers market was 2004. And we developed a client base, and all that time, during the time we were there, we were looking for our own land. Like, that was the goal, and it became a lot more challenging than we thought. So we looked at 150 properties during that time, drove all over Northeast Oklahoma, just couldn't find what we were looking for. Mainly good soil was really hard to come by in the state.
Is that because of the classic kind of red dirt of Oklahoma is not great for farming?
Yeah. So if you go north, you encounter more glacial deposits, and the glaciers didn't make it this far south. So we don't have that really deep, rich soil that you find in Iowa and in the upper Midwest. So the good soils around here tend to be around rivers where you're going to get alluvial deposits from flooding. And that's what happens with good soil. A lot of times it's going to flood. So we actually did look at some good places with great soil, but we weren't willing to lose a crop every couple years because of flooding. So it was very frustrating to find good soil and then look at the flood maps and be like, oh man, you know, this isn't going to work. So long story short, we finally, kind of at the 11th hour of our search of just feeling like it was never going to happen, we found our place. It's 65 miles east of Tulsa, so about an hour on 412 towards Arkansas. We have 20 acres, and it had an old little farmhouse, and it was right on this beautiful creek called Spring Creek, and we fell in love with that immediately. We took a little gamble on the soil. The soil is okay. It's not terrible. It's not great, but over the years, we've worked with it, and it's provided us with our livelihood, and so we're very lucky, feel like, where we are. It's a beautiful spot.
In some ways, it sounds like a very romantic story of deciding to go into the agricultural life and to make a commitment, really a personal and financial commitment to organic farming. And one thing I wonder is when you decided, the two of you decided, first of all, it was just the two of you. So that seems daunting in and of itself. But then I guess you had to make some kind of projection or prediction about how you would do or what kind of output you'd need to make money or break even. So how has it conformed to your expectations, you know, without revealing numbers?
Oh, we're okay with revealing numbers too. We had some sense, like a tiny sense from the farm that we interned on in California, because they were really generous enough to let us get access to their financial records, which a lot of internships don't do just because it is personal information. But it's really hard if you're starting out as a small-scale organic farmer to find out those details. So we did better our first year than we thought we would, but we still, like, your gross and your net are very different. So we grossed $35,000 our first year, but we, like, netted on our taxes a couple of thousand. We worked at Bob and Peggy's pecan farm that first fall, actually. Since then, though, the CSA, our community-supported agriculture program, has given us working capital in the fall and winter sufficient to get us through. And we also have developed, you know, savings plan, all that stuff. So by the time we left Bob and Peggy's, I think we were grossing around $60,000, and we were able to buy our farm outright just because it is Oklahoma and we had a really low cap. We had like a $100,000 cap. We have since put in that and more. but now we gross somewhere around $100,000. But what our net is, you know, still significantly less than that. You know, what we live on versus, like, our taxes might be a little bit different just for things like standard mileage rate per diem. But we live on somewhere around, like, $40,000 to $50,000 a year. And that's not a lot. And some people would hear that and be totally horrified and think, I never want my kid to farm. But we do have, like, a lot of choices and flexibility in that lifestyle. You don't have a lot of flexibility in the growing season, but you do have this meaningful winter season, which we have always managed to make really a little too full and not very restful, just with, you know, volunteer work or things that come our way.
But it's definitely not the money that keeps us in farming over the years, because, I mean, there's lots of, especially farming in Oklahoma, there's lots of trials and tribulations with weather extremes. We've seen a lot of it. So yeah, it's really the love of the work. We really enjoy working as a family. We have a daughter, so she gets to be out there with us. We get to be outside. We get to do something that provides nourishment for people, which to us is really important. It would be hard for us just to drop off our produce at a store, walk away, never see the end user. But being at the farmer's market and through the CSA, we it's really the relationships we have with people that keep us going. So if we're having a rough go of it and all it takes is go to a market and suddenly, you know, we realize why we're doing what we're doing, or we get like an email that just says, you know, thank you for what you do. You know, we love your produce. And that's what sustains us. And it's not, you know, it's definitely not a moneymaker thing. But I mean, we're fortunate that we get to live very comfortably. We're happy with that. But it's not what drives us. And that's what I would say all farmers are going to tell you, is that it's the love of the job of growing food. And for us, especially growing, you know, growing organic food, food that we feel is clean, is going to promote health, not degrade health. And we're also very concerned about our surrounding environment, and especially being on a beautiful creek like Spring Creek that, you know, is supposedly one of the most pristine creeks, if not the most pristine creek in Oklahoma. And so we take it very seriously in terms of how we manage our land. And we have buffers of trees just in case there is any runoff. We grow our own fertility through cover cropping. So I don't want to get too much in the weeds, so to speak, about cover cropping, but we grow crops just for the soil. We take land out of production in winter and also in summer, and we just grow a crop just to turn back into the soil and feed the soil. So over the years of doing that, we've really built up our soil and have to import very little fertility into our farm, which is very nice. It's not to say it's 100%, but that's the goal, is to continually improve and hopefully not import any inputs at all. Yeah, it's a labor of love, and of both for other people and for the environment.
And I'll just say that, you know, there's Gandhi saying, be the change you wish to see in the world. And we feel really lucky that we get to do this thing that we really love. Like, are there times when it's hard? Are there times when it's 100 outside and we're not totally sure why we're doing it, of course. But at this point, I can't even imagine doing anything else. And I think when we started out, we actually thought we would do more international farm work again. And we still do that a bit in our off season, but I think we thought that we would kind of phase out of farming at some point and start doing more of that international farmer connection work again. And I mean, I think we still hope to do that at some point, but we also can't give up growing food. I mean, we just love it too much and we feel so lucky to be able to do it. So
you're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And we're talking today about the health benefits of sustainable organic agriculture with Mike Appel and Emily Oakley, who are the owner-operators of Three Springs Farm in Oaks, Oklahoma. And you may know them as vendors at the Cherry Street Farmers Market. And Mike and Emily, you've touched on so many things I want to ask about, but let's just start, because I know many of our listeners may well know you personally, but for those that don't or don't know what a CSA is, or Community Supported Agriculture, just share with us what that whole model is.
Back in the 80s, when a lot of people, especially in the Northeast and the West Coast, had kind of moved back to the land from that movement, started growing organic food, and were looking for creative solutions for marketing that food, a farmer came up with this creative idea of, like, basically the farmer grows all this food, doesn't know what the crop is going to be like, doesn't know what the weather will bring, and so has a great deal of risk. Is there a way to involve the community in that risk and in the abundance? So she created this concept of community-supported agriculture. And as it was originally constructed, like, people would become members of the farm, and then they would just get whatever was available that week in whatever abundance. So if the farm had a bumper crop of tomatoes, they would get it. But if the farm didn't have any tomatoes, they wouldn't. And they would know that, and they would be sharing in that. It's evolved quite a bit in many different ways across the country since then. We did have a CSA that was a little bit more like that when we first started our farm, and there are people who still miss that basket CSA with their name tag on their basket each week. But being a two-person operation, that's where we do have some constraints. We don't really have the labor to do some of the things that we might wish we could do like that. So in this case, our customers, our CSA members, join the farm, and they pay sort of either a lump sum amount in the winter or over installments, just depending upon what's most comfortable for them. And they're buying into the season, and they're helping us get that upfront capital for seeds or potting soil or whatever it might be in the wintertime. And then over the course of the season, they come to our market stand, and they just pick out whatever they want. We add up their total. We subtract it from a running balance. We add 10% on to whatever amount they choose to pay. And then they get a weekly newsletter with recipes that we've created from the farm, kind of a little update about what's happening in terms of photos and just stories from the farm, philosophical musings sometimes, and then what we'll have that week. So what's great about it is that many of our CSA members have been with us really from the beginning. It gives them the flexibility to pick out what they want, come when they want, get what they want. If they don't like tomatoes, they don't ever have to get them. Or if they love them, they can get, you know, 50 pounds in one day. And it gives us the creativity and flexibility not to have to grow, you know, 100 perfect heads of this type of lettuce or heads of celery in a given week. So I think it's kind of a win-win situation for our customers and us.
My wife and I love the Cherry Street Farmers Market and are there every Saturday that we're in town. And there's definitely a void when you guys sort of pack up a little bit earlier than the rest of the market. Mm-hmm. It seems like maybe before Labor Day sometimes, you're very discreet or you have a very definite endpoint to your season. I know lots of fellow market goers are always like, where are Three Springs? Where are Mike and Emily? Where'd they go? Why aren't they here this week? And so there's this palpable void. How come you guys aren't there the whole season going through into late October?
Yeah, I don't know if Emily does, but I do have some guilt about it. I mean, I would love to grow produce all year round, but I just know for us that's not sustainable. So we're learning in California where they do have year-round growing conditions. We saw the toll it took on the farmers. They were exhausted. They just never got that break. They never got that winter to kind of hibernate a little bit, rejuvenate, come back into the spring ready to go. They were just trugging along just, you know, every season. And so for us, we saw that and we knew right away that we needed a break. And so we've kind of taken off weeks as we've gone along, and now we've really, the last several years or more, it's been Labor Day, and that's been a good stopping point for us. We're The summer crops are winding down. September is a kind of a tricky month because you really, in order to get the cool season stuff, as the kind of cool weather comes in, you need to plant it during a very hot period of time. And that's really hard to do with some of the seeds that you're wanting to plant. And for us, summer is so profitable with tomatoes that all our attention is going towards tomatoes. And we really don't want to take anything away from that because that's really a big part of our farm and being profitable is growing a lot of tomatoes.
We also, Mike mentioned growing, we grow cover crops for our soil, but we tell people it's for our souls, but also for our soil. So, you know, Mike covered sort of the personal part, but the practical part is that we did buy this farm that has very limited amount of arable land on it. So if we are going to try to get away from using manure on our farm, for example, for fertility or importing, you know, mined materials, organic materials for our fertility, and we want to try to grow our fertility, we really need to get our cover crop in as early in September as we can because you're hitting the equinox already. And so the daylight hours really diminish rapidly from September, October into November. So the more growth we can get before the winter sets in, the better it is for our soil. So we're also trying to put the whole farm into a cover crop as quickly as possible.
What are a couple of examples of cover crops just for a neophyte?
Yeah, so right now we have a buckwheat, oat, vetch, which is a legume, which fixes nitrogen from the air into the soil. Do we get Austrian winter pea?
A little bit of Austrian winter peas, yeah.
And then we have a radish, which grew in the fall and then died when it got cold, but it breaks open the soil. It's a forage radish that kind of, it kind of sends in these deep roots and then opens up the soil when it dies. So that's our fall winter cover crop.
That's so interesting. Is it cover crop purely? So is it plowed under or mulched under?
Yeah, it's in the spring, kind of as we need land, we'll till in a section of what we need of the cover crop, usually a couple weeks ideally beforehand, so it has time to break down. The soil has time to digest it. And then just as we need more land, we till it in. And that way the land, we try to have our land covered as much as possible. So either with a cover crop or with an actual, you know, a cash crop of lettuce, broccoli, or whatever. And yeah, and then summer, we take half the land where our spring crops were, where we take all those, the lettuces and the broccolis and the carrots are all done. Usually at the end of June, beginning of July, so that's about half the farm. That gets into a summer cover crop. And that cover crop is amazing to come out and see because it's usually, by the end of its time, it's usually about 8 feet, 9 feet tall. It's amazing. Wow. You can get lost in there fairly easily. So that one we grow, it's something called sorghum Sudan grass. It's a very tall grass. Sun hemp, not related to hemp, but a nitrogen fixer, which puts nitrogen from the air into the soil, and soybeans and sunflowers. And so what they're finding, without trying to get too technical, but the more diversity of crops you have, the more diversity of life you're going to have in the soil. So you're going to be encouraging all different types of bacteria. And so with everything, you want diversity. Diversity is such a strength with nature. And so we grow a diversity of crops, but we also want to grow a diversity of cover crops. And that will give us a diversity of soil life, which is key.
And Emily and Mike, there's something that, as someone who pays attention to what's going on with your farm, last summer sort of arose a new challenge, and perhaps unanticipated one, that involved a property owner or someone bought property right adjacent to you, and they wanted to put a big chicken house on that property. And you rallied your members, your CSA folks, to try to move to action about this. So what's wrong? I mean, why is that necessarily a bad thing if someone wants to farm chickens nearby?
So yeah, last April, a property that was about a half a mile up the creek from us was sold to someone who wanted to put in 6 chicken houses, and each house would have 50,000 birds in it. And there could be a grow out of about 5 different cycles a year. So each house could have 250 or 300,000 birds in a year on it, or, you know, could be up to 1.5 million on that property within a year. So maybe that right there answers for some people what's wrong with that, and maybe others aren't so sure. Chickens poop, and they actually have a slurry that they emit. It's not just like urine and feces. And many Tulsans will probably remember the lawsuit against some of the chicken companies in Arkansas for polluting Tulsa and Oklahoma waterways, not Tulsa waterways, but Oklahoma waterways. And the problem with that many birds and that many chicken houses in one area is what happens to all of that manure. And when it's close to a creek, there are definitely concerns that it's going to get into the creek. And high levels of phosphorus have definitely been shown to have very negative environmental impacts on waters. And I won't go into all the details of that. But when we heard about it, we thought, okay, maybe this is going to happen, but maybe not. We're going to just try and see who we can call and who we can mobilize and who will be willing to work alongside us in this effort to try to get these chicken houses moved. So it's a long and very miraculous story, and we're like a small part of that whole piece. It was a huge community-wide effort, both within Oaks and the surrounding region and people in Tulsa who cared and did something. Ultimately, the Cherokee Nation amazingly came in and purchased that property. It was a very historical one, so they can't go and purchase all the threatened properties, but this was actually one of the End of the Trail of Tears locations, so it was... And it's close to many other historical and important sites for the Cherokee Nation. So it was a really important piece for them. And we are very lucky that they bought it. But in being successful on that land, we made those 6 chicken houses somebody else's 6 chicken house problem. And it grew into this broader, wider effort. I think when people in the community realized that there were a lot of us that were concerned about all these houses that were going up, because it wasn't just happening near us. We were seeing them and have been seeing them spring up by the dozens and actually hundreds over the last year. It created this movement of people who said, hey, wait, there's got to be something we can do. So yes, in addition to farming over the last, 9 months, this has become a huge part of our lives. And I'll let Mike chime in with
some
thoughts.
We could definitely do a whole segment on this. This has really become a part-time job at least. But we really see this as one of the biggest threats to our farm. Water quantity and quality could be both very possibly negatively impacted by this development. So right now there's no regulations. People can build these houses wherever they want, near city limits, near cemeteries, near churches, near schools. There's just no regulation. There's a $10 registration fee. That's all they have to do. And there's about 20 families that are responsible for most of this recent development or expansion. It's about 200 houses. And well over half are not from Oklahoma. They're absentee. They don't live here. This isn't your neighbor who wants to try to save the family farm and put up a couple houses. This is a totally different paradigm that we're dealing with.
This is industrial scale.
This is industrial scale for sure. Simmons is an Arkansas-based company, so there's very little benefit Oklahoma gets. There's very little tax base here. Property values are declining. If these go up next to you, your property values will plummet. No one wants to be next to these mega houses. And so, the community has really come together and just said, look, we need protection. We need setbacks for how close you can be to a house, how close you can be to a body of water. Even this year, we saw our spring, which we don't know if it's related to the chickens, but it's sure as coincidental that we saw our spring for the first time dry up. 2012 was a lot drier, and it flowed that whole year. And we know that chickens need a lot of water. They're digging very deep wells. They're not metered at all. So they're taking obscene amounts of water that, and we, there's no study to say that this is sustainable, that the aquifers in Northeast Oklahoma can sustain this. And so it's really a threat to the whole region. It's not just a threat to neighbors. I feel like it's, although the city does have special protections in the Uchi-Spavinaw watershed where Tulsa does get its drinking water, it's really kind of playing with fire because there's lots of houses that have went up within that watershed, close to 100 alone just within the Uchi-Spavinaw watershed. Most of the time that litter is spread not too far from the houses just because it's a lot to truck it out. So with the 200 houses, annually it's about 1.2 million pounds of manure, raw manure. What's the plan? We have never been shown a plan or how it's going to be dealt with, where it's going to go. There is a bill in the House right now to try to get some setbacks. That's kind of the first step, is to get setbacks to prevent any future development. And then once we get the setbacks that are reasonable, you know, I would think at least a half mile from a residence, what we have to do is then deal with the litter and then also the water extraction, how much, make sure they're not taking too much water, because we need water for ourselves and our livelihood and our farm. And obviously people need water to live out there. People are on wells. They don't have any other source.
Well, two of the things that surprised me the most in that whole story was the fact that there really were no regulations at all. Like the story highlighted the fact that there was just absolutely no environmental protection whatsoever in the sort of the agricultural sector. And secondly, that the customers for this massive amount of chicken, it's all really exported, is what you were telling me. It goes to China, essentially?
That's what we've been told. I mean, we obviously don't know because we're not industry insiders, but we were told by a nonprofit organization that works on these issues that the U.S. met its domestic consumption maybe 20 years ago, that this new growth is for the Pacific Rim, so for export. So yes, we don't know that for a fact, obviously, but it is very troubling to consider the possibility that Oklahoma's rural communities are being degraded and demoralized, not even for local consumption or even national consumption. But the thing is, chicken houses have been around for quite a while in northeastern Oklahoma and northwestern Arkansas. You can drive around and see plenty of abandoned barns that were smaller, that kind of didn't grow with the industry, that they couldn't get bigger. Our concern is that these are sort of treated as like temporary structures, basically. Like at some point, the industry expands their operation scale, and what used to be an acceptable barn size is no longer acceptable. The farmers either have to rebuild all new barns or abandon operations. So that's why we have all of these skeletons throughout northeastern Oklahoma of these abandoned houses. What's going to happen to all the houses that they've already built? And we've been told that this is just the first phase in their expansion, that there are two more phases coming. We don't know, because we hear all of this sort of like through the grapevine hearsay, which is part of the problem. When you are going to do something this massive, have such an enormous impact on so many people, so many communities, and the land itself, it seems like there should be a place for public conversation and dialogue. And that's what surprised us about the property that was a half mile upstream from us. At first, I thought, this can't possibly be true. Like, there's no way they're going to build these houses here. It's right on this creek. It's right next to this school. It's right next to the Oaks Indian Mission, which is a residential facility for Native American youth. And what was so striking about this process was realizing that, yes, there was absolutely nothing stopping them from putting them anywhere that they wanted to.
Well, this is definitely an ongoing story, and it sounds like one we're going to have you back to discuss in more depth later, because we're out of time. But Mike Appel and Emily Oakley, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Mike and Emily are the owner-operators of Three Springs Farm in Oaks, Oklahoma, and are regular vendors at the Cherry Street Farmers Market. Thank you guys so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.